Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. We are providing a forum for those individuals who have quality backgrounds, who have spent a great deal of time and scholarship simply reviewing the scientific literature to ask a basic question. Is there substantial proof that vaccines are safe and effective? And if not, why have we been led to believe that we should have full faith and trust in the government's vaccine-mandated policies and some states' mandatory vaccine policies, such as California? Joining us today, Dr. James Lynn Wheeler, W-E-I-L-E-R. He is the CEO and director of the Institute for Pure and Applied Knowledge, which exists to conduct research in the public interest without profit motive. He is a long-time biomedical researcher. Now, he is best known for contributions to advances in medical bioinformatics and for his three books, including Ebolae, An Evolving Story, Cures versus Profits, Successes in Translational Research, and The Environmental and Genetic Causes of Autism, which was in 2017. James is a true blue academic and has directed the analysis of data for over 100 medical studies. And he served as a founding editor-in-chief of the Journal of Cancer Informatics and served on the editorial board of Cancer Research. And he's published more than 48 papers in reputable journals. He lives over in Western Pennsylvania with two well-adjusted teenage sons and his fiancée. In his blog, I'll spell it for you, is James Lynn Sweller. That's JamesLynnSweeler.com. And that contains a deep analysis of issues that confront all of us today on the mismatches that exist between biomedical science and public health policy. Nice to have you with us today, James.
Thank you, Gary. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
James, I would like for you to begin by talking about something that is rarely, if ever, discussed in the media or with a relationship between a physician, a pharmacist, a nurse, and the person receiving a vaccine. How viruses engage in molecular mimicry, which induces autoimmunity. And we all know today, and the scientific literature proves, that we have an epidemic of autoimmune conditions in children. We have allergies. We have inner ear infections, asthma, and levels we've never seen before in American history. And they've been accelerating if you study the scientific literature from the 1990s when the vaccine schedule began to change and increase till today. The forum is yours. Take your time.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, well, I'll be happy to discuss molecular mimicry and other ways that viruses and other pathogens can induce autoimmunity. The first thing I'd like to point out is when pharmaceutical companies would like to make a drug for autoimmune disorders such as asthma, Sjögren's syndrome, autoimmune rhinitis, demyelinating disorders, and so on, they universally use a substance to induce autoimmunity by injecting the substance into mice and rats to create the autoimmune condition in mice and rats. And then they test the drug that they're interested in bringing forward to see if it reduces the severity of the symptoms of autoimmunity. And that substance is aluminum hydroxide. And that substance, as you know, Gary, is a adjuvant used in vaccines. It's in about 60% of the vaccines that are in the CDC schedule. And aluminum has many of this form of aluminum has many effects on the body. Part of the way that it induces the immune reaction and enhances the immune reaction of vaccines is to actually create cellular damage. So in injection of aluminum is by definition a wound in whatever tissue it's a cellular damage and release of cytokines. The problem is that for your run-of-the-mill animal models, mice or rats, to create these types of autoimmune conditions, you have to use about 10 to 20,000 times the dose per weight of the animal to induce the autoimmunity in the presence of the antigen, the antigen source. One condition that is fairly widespread, you do not have to even use an antigen source, is asthma. You can create asthma in rats and mice simply by injecting enough aluminum hydroxide without any special additional exposure to an allergen source. But for food allergies like peanuts and so on, if you inject enough aluminum hydroxide and then feed peanuts or peanut butter to the mice or rats, sure enough, they'll develop a food allergy. So I went to the biomedical literature and I downloaded all of the studies that I could find that used aluminum hydroxide to induce autoimmunity in animals. And I looked at the per body weight dose to determine, you know, how close are we to the same doses that we see that children might be exposed to in the CDC schedule. And what I found was remarkable. For your run-of-the-mill mouse or rat, you do have to use 10 or 20,000 times the dose. But it's still aluminum hydroxide, so it does point to the biological mechanism. It points to plausibility. But if the rat or mouse model is a engineered rat or mouse model that has a predisposition to the autoimmune condition itself that's under study, you can use as low as five times the amount in a single dose vaccine per body weight. And I think, Gary, this is why we see, you know, people that have problems with vaccines often, most often, have problems, as Dr. Goldman and Neil Miller have pointed out over the years by their studies, that having more than one vaccine at a time, and I don't know if that's per day or per week or what the body might tolerate, and having a genetic predisposition really puts people at very serious risk of lifelong disorders and conditions.
We're never given the package insert when people go to get a flu shot. But for the MMR vaccine, we looked at the package insert, and there are 45 paragraphs of side effects. And one of the first side effects of the MMR vaccine, the measles, mumps vaccine, is measles. So if you're a common sense person with no science background, you're going to say, you mean if I take a measles vaccine, I could end up with the measles from the vaccine? And the answer is yes. But you could also end up with autism spectrum disorder. So they're actually putting it in their package inserts. You could end up with brain damage and mitochondrial dysfunction, etc. So we never think about this. And in fact, of all the advocates that you have today, highly educated, very outspoken, very determined, they're advocates after the fact, after they trusted and ended up seeing a completely normal developing child regress into that dark, shadowed place called autism spectrum disorder or some other condition, maybe delayed learning, delayed speech, not being able to have full eye contact. And we never ask, gee whiz, what is the likelihood I will have a post-vaccine demyelinization syndrome? But it happens. And yet the CDC, the FDA, the U.S. Public Health Service, virtually all of the media supports vaccination, even supporting mandatory vaccination. So that leads me to ask a very basic question. Why did you trust, as a pro-vaccine person, you believed in vaccines, that they were safe, until you found out the hard way about the risks of vaccination? Give us your story and then speculate, and it's purely a subjective speculation, as to why so many other people, the vast majority of people, will never look at the material to become intentionally aware, intentionally informed. They simply stay unintentionally ignorant until there's a disaster. Then they become an activist.
Yeah, so Gary, it's a great question. Actually, both of my sons are, you know, vaccinated per the vaccine schedule. I stopped at HPV. I learned about the problems with science from a scientific perspective, the vaccine safety science. You say it was the hard way, and it has been a long road for me and a journey, but I just simply continued to be an objective scientist. As I was writing my book, Cures versus Profits, I had made a commitment to myself that if I found any problem with any of the 16 topics that I decided I was going to talk about in biomedical research, in that book, I went into the book optimistically to celebrate the successes in biological and biomedical research. And I thought I would just, it was the last chapter that I thought I would write. I thought it was going to be an easy chapter, and I just walked right into, you know, the literature with very naively about vaccines. And in retrospect, of course, now it's much more obvious to me that there can be problems, but the issue is, although I was involved in 100 studies at the University of Pittsburgh on many, many different types of diseases and disorders with colleagues across many departments, there was never any vaccine safety research conducted at the University of Pittsburgh. It's captured and it's siloized, and it's all done by contract within, or it's either done within the CDC or done by contract to specialized groups, and in many cases, foreign groups, like the Danish group that does CDC research. We don't have American scientists that are doing this type of research at universities. You would think with all the pediatric hospitals that we have around and the possibility of adverse side effects that this research would be widespread so we could find ways to make vaccines safer, as we now know that the 1986 National Vaccine Childhood Injury Act mandated vaccines to be made safer and mandated HHS to find ways to identify those who are susceptible. Well, it turns out that some of my research since then, you know, Guillain-Barré syndrome is a autoimmune condition. It causes paralysis. Many people are aware of it. Well, when they first did the first population-wide vaccination against the flu in 1976, they saw many cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome. And it wasn't until many, many, many years later that the Guillain-Barré syndrome was actually added to the table of vaccine injuries that are recognized by the HHS, for which people are entitled to compensation without fighting to prove causality. And, you know, remarkably, in the analysis of the scientific literature, I found that the study of diseases of unknown origin, mysterious diseases of unknown origin, where no one seems to know where they're coming from, actually flatlined from the 1940s in PubMed literature to 1976. And after 1976, when they started doing whole population vaccination against the flu, there's a linear increase that continues to this day of studies of disorders. So where no one knows what the causality is, no one knows the root cause. And take, for instance, type 1 diabetes. We know that that's increasing. We absolutely know that that's increasing. We also know it has an autoimmune component. We know that vaccines can induce autoimmunity. And it doesn't take too much to say that type 1 diabetes, the epidemic of type 1 diabetes, some of it may be due to widespread vaccination. Indiscriminate vaccination was never seen in previous generations as a wise or necessary thing. They thought it was inefficient, it would be too expensive. And instead of doing widespread indiscriminate vaccination, they advocated for ring or bubble vaccination. So if you look at the current measles outbreaks that are happening, first of all, there's a lot of misinformation about the actual nature of these outbreaks. What the public health officials do not bring forward is really telling. So we just had Senate hearings on, you know, what's driving the increase in the outbreaks. Well, there is no increase in these outbreaks. If you look at the number of outbreaks per year over the last 20 years, there's an increase in outbreaks every 3 or 4 years. Well, Gary, you'll remember with measles, it was a disease that had a 3 or 4 year cycle, a natural epidemiologic cycle of the rates. And so we have measles increases around the world every 3 or 4 years, and people from around the world come to the United States, and they bring an active infection. They create a small transmission chain. We're told that we have to remove personal belief exemptions because these exemptions are increasing. They're not. The use of exemptions is flatlined, and it's been the same for the past decade. We're cited wrong statistics in Clark County over the number of families that have personal belief exemptions. There were some people citing it as high as 18%, when in reality it was around 2.3%, which is on par for the statewide rate of personal belief exemptions. We're also not told that these outbreaks are occurring in ethnic or religious groups. In the Jewish community in Rockland County and in New York City, and in a Slavic community, some of these families do not vaccinate for religious reasons. It has nothing to do with personal belief exemptions. And so that kind of misdirection and misinformation is being used to try to change political policy over vaccination coverage and whether people should have personal belief exemptions. And the reason why I was so ignorant was because I fell victim to the misinformation campaign that was developed by the CDC and HHS in collusion with the pharmaceutical companies, who stand to lose billions and billions, $40 billion market, unless they can have full population vaccination. No one asks the question, for every vaccine, is it necessary to have full population vaccination? It's just assumed. Wow, look at the market. Look at the size of the market. Everybody needs it. Everybody benefits. But the risks are minimized. There's a systematic program. It's in the DNA of the CDC to teach people to minimize the perception of risk. But the risk itself is never minimized. There's nothing done to reduce the risk in the United States. Whereas the benefits of vaccines are exaggerated. And the problem with many of the vaccines now, of course, is that they're getting older. The vaccines for which we have, the MMR, for example, the contract was renewed under suspicious circumstances, where there's a case of scientists who used to work at the Merck, were told, well, the efficacy of the vaccine is too low in this study. We have to increase the efficacy, how well the vaccine works, before we can submit the data to the FDA. They only found 18% efficacy of the MMR against the mumps virus. And so they were instructed, it is alleged, to put rabbit antibodies into the sample and make it appear as though they had achieved the gold standard of 96% efficacy. Why? Because there are other mumps vaccines on the market, then they didn't want to lose the contract. But as an evolutionary biologist and an understanding genetics, we absolutely have every reason to believe that vaccines have a shelf life, a molecular shelf life. The vaccine type evolves away from the wild type in nature and by mutation. And those mutations accumulate every year. So every year, every vaccine should be getting weaker and weaker and weaker. And it would be impossible that the MMR could retain a 96% efficacy since 1960. It's not possible. Mathematically, I've done the calculations to look at how many mutations are likely to have happened, given the baseline mutation rate of the virus. And I calculate that six of the vaccines on the schedule, Gary, are so attenuated by mutations in terms of their ability to induce an immune reaction, that they're basically worthless. And so on top of it, other problems that we're never told about are things like if you have a vaccine against mumps, you can carry mumps but not have symptoms. If you have a vaccine against pertussis, like all medical people do, including pediatricians do every 10 years, you can become a silent carrier, and you can be the wolf that's actually infecting the patients in your practice. We're not told that the same is true for measles. And many scientists, even some of the most vaccine risk aware, the most knowledgeable scientists I know, have not yet accepted that measles, asymptomatic measles infection and asymptomatic transmission actually occurs. But we know that it occurs. I was on a phone call with public health official, the acting director of the Department of Health in New York City. I forget her name right now, but and there were some parents who asked me to be on the phone call with her and a councilman wanted me to discuss measles with her. And I said, well, you know, we know that asymptomatic transmission occurs and an asymptomatic infection occurs with pertussis and with mumps. And so from a public health policy perspective, we know that Merck may have falsified the efficacy data on the mumps portion of the MMR. Let's talk about asymptomatic transmission and measles. And she said it does not occur. And I said, well, I know how to get a hold of you. I'll send you the science that shows that it does occur. It occurs at a rate. If you have a measles-infected individual who develops symptoms, they're going to go home and they're not going to stay in school. But if you have a measles-infected individual and they go to school, they're not going to have, and they're vaccinated, they're not going to have symptoms and they can spread the wild type. It's not just vaccine shedding, not vaccine type shedding. They will become infected with the wild type and they can spread it to the people who are at risk, the at-risk communities and so on. And yet we only keep the unvaccinated kids from school. We don't keep the vaccinated kids who might be positive for measles from school. And so there's a disparity between the actual knowledge bases in the scientific literature and the policy. And I'm fascinated by that. I'm fascinated, increasingly fascinated by how science, there's a failure of translation from science into the clinic, and there's a failure of translation, proper translation of science into public health policy. In the case of the MMR study, there was a recent study just published by the Danish group on the MMR, and they allegedly showed, if you look at the media and if you look at how it's going to be used clinically, they allegedly showed that there's no association between MMR and autism rates. And yet, if you look at the study design, there's, you know, problems with the way that they have defined their study groups. And this is universally true across almost all of the vaccine safety studies, where they will exclude portions of the population, the pediatric population, and then just restrict their analysis to a subset. And I've seen them remove, in other studies, I've seen them remove patients that have seizure disorders. Well, seizure disorders and autism actually overlap in their molecular pathways of how it manifests itself, what causes autism from environmental exposures. And so, they have problems with the study-wide autism rate not matching the rate of autism in Denmark. The rate of autism in Denmark is lower than the United States. 10 years ago, it was 1 in 1,000, and now it's 1 in 100. Well, why is it only 1 in 100 there? Well, how can the people of Denmark survive without the CDC schedule? If Denmark's schedule is different than that in the United States and they have lower autism rates, shouldn't we go over and figure out what they're doing? But they didn't consider any serious question that we know. The scientific literature is screaming to me, we need to see what happens with exposure to multiple vaccines at the same time that you're getting MMR. They didn't include that. They just said, well, if you have the MMR versus, not having the MMR, and it was a sibling study. And they're not interested in, objectively selecting their data analysis plan. They subjectively define their data analysis plan. I was very popular as a data analyst and a senior research scientist at the University of Pittsburgh because I insisted on objectively determining the study design of your research studies. And, the use of epidemiology is the wrong type of study, as you've heard probably a million times, that we need to have randomized prospective clinical trials that use a valid placebo. But even if you're going to do, that's an experiment. But if you're going to do, if you're going to do observational studies like these cohort studies that are being done, case control studies that are being done, at least define your analysis plan and your study design objectively. There's ways to do that that are never done. And of course, that particular study had huge conflicts of interest. Participants actually, you know, have stock in Eli Lilly and Pfizer. They have stock in Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson. And so, you know, there's a real problem. The science for profit is hurting people around the world. And we need to somehow dissociate profit motive from vaccine safety science. I don't believe CDC should be involved in vaccine safety science ever again. I think it should be stripped away from them. They should be independent research entities that are that they themselves do not profit from vaccination rates. They're not beholden to the CDC. They're not beholden to the AAP. They're just doing basic research, clinical research to determine, what the safety profile of the vaccine schedule is and what the safety profile of individual vaccines are. And for those of your listeners who are abjectly anti-vaccine because they saw their child severely injured, please understand when I say that I would like to see vaccine safety studies done, I'm comparing that to, you know, done appropriately, I'm comparing that to a future in which this fraudulent, biased approach towards vaccine safety continues on for the next 50 years. I would much rather have, you know, real feedback to the people who want to have vaccines in the society that there's a problem with their product and what those problems are and find ways to help them understand that they do have to try to make them safer, at least get aluminum out, at least get mercury out, at least remove the unsafe epitopes, these proteins that match the human proteins. Why inject them? We can, through genetic recombination technology, create vaccines that do not include any proteins that look like human proteins. It seems so irresponsible and so unethical to continue down the same path.
James, I'd like you to focus your energy on a few more areas here, please. I have a background as a PhD in human nutrition and public health science, and I've conducted over 40 clinical studies from arthritis and menopause to helping brain-injured individuals, and several have been published in peer-reviewed journals, and they've gotten acknowledged throughout the scientific community. And my approach is always this. First, use common sense and reason. In other words, don't start with a predetermined idea and then selectively cherry-pick what you can to support that. And that's exactly what vaccine science has become. I'll give you an example of why I do not trust it. And I've spent 15,000-plus hours studying it. Let's say that you have a group of individuals who received the flu vaccine. At the end of a period of time, let's say it's a year, they determine a figure that the vaccine was effective because this number of people came down with the flu. They're giving 100% of the credit for those who did not to the vaccine. There is nothing more unscientific than that. They did not consider in a single case did someone changed their diet. Were they healthy to begin with and just wanted to take the vaccine because they thought it might provide an extra layer of health? Were they taking vitamin D or getting adequate vitamin D or the omega-3 fatty acids or vitamin C? Did they live in Florida where they're getting vitamin C through citrus and vitamin D through the sun and exercising outside more? Or did they live up in North Dakota and might not have gotten these and might have had a lot of time where they didn't have adequate sunlight, were more depressed, and depression brings down the immune system, making you more susceptible to infections and inflammatory conditions, including influenza or the flu or colds. None of this is considered. So yet in science, any given court that is given the vaccine, if you don't come down with it, you get 100% credit to the vaccine. Similarly with breast cancer. breast cancer, once it's diagnosed and once it's treated, a lot of the cancer, the majority of it, is a ductal cancer, which is not a metastasizing cancer. It's not a killer cancer. And yet they'll take credit for everyone who doesn't die of cancer. If you live 5 years after your diagnosis, 100% of the credit goes to the treatment. What if you became aware? What if your physician wanted to put you on a healthier regimen? What if you had been a drinker and smoker and non-exerciser and you began to change those habits? None of that is counted. So I have so little faith in science today of being objective and fair, and we know how much of the scientific literature is falsified, where people just lie because it's in their financial or career interest to do so. And then proprietary science, corporate science, as you mentioned. So the average person not having a background in science would not understand these differences, wouldn't be able to parse off these subtleties. So I'd like for you to address the idea that before you can have a legitimate science in something to see if it works, why don't you just ask basic questions about, is the proof of antibody creation in and of itself protective? Because I'll show you people that don't have an antibody response who are completely protected, and those who have full antibodies who are not protected and come down with the disease. The people who've been given the vaccine, frequently the measles vaccine, which can shed for weeks afterwards, and the polio the same, they're, like you said, they're spreading it all over their classrooms, on desks, and we know that bacteria and viruses can live a substantial amount of time outside the human body. Think of the people that go home vaccinated, and they have five members in their family, and they think they're protected because the false illusions, you've been vaccinated. They use a toothbrush. Every time they put that toothbrush back in their mouth, they're compounding the problem by reinfection, rebound infection. People touch doorknobs, refrigerator handles. They touch the bathroom, and all that is contaminating it. We're never told what happens when the other members of the family come down with a condition that was caused by the shedding of viruses and bacteria out of a person that was vaccinated. We're never taught that. We're never taught about how easy it is to spread viruses out of our body by sneezing and coughing. So when you look at all of the different aspects that can contribute to a disease or healthy state, we're excluding some of the most important. We're relying solely upon a medical model. We don't give any credibility at all, ever, to what a person could do on their own. And up at the University of Pennsylvania, you have a teacher there who's very important to the university, Paul Offit. Offit made a statement to the effect that his first statement was you could take 10,000, you know, vaccines. Okay, if he believes that, why not really show it? Why not allow himself to be vaccinated with the current vaccines that are in schedule 10,000 times at once and see what happens to him? Maybe he's right, but what if he isn't? And why do we think that a tiny little baby weighing 8 pounds when born needs a hepatitis vaccine when the mother could have been tested to show that she is hepatitis negative? So why give a hepatitis B vaccine to a baby that doesn't even have a developed immune system? The immune system is going to come from the mother's breast milk.
Yeah, I agree.
But we won't do that. So I see everything involving the world of vaccine as being substantially compromised by unethical principles. And the people who are interested in the truth, who want a vaccine that's safe, are not looking at, you know, a baby getting the vaccine from the mother's breast milk. You never hear that discussed. In fact, there's a whole movement to get away from breastfeeding for years.
Yeah, I saw the CDC calling for mothers to stop breastfeeding.
Hence, her making money became more important than the development of her child. And then why don't we take a group of 10,000 children who have never been vaccinated for anything, follow them for 5 years, and every 6 months do complete workups on their biochemistry and their health. They keep health diaries, and then you see a group that are vaccinated, a group non-vaccinated, and what's the outcome at the end of a period of time? Then why don't you do the same thing, except you add a third quadrant, and that would be individuals who are fed nutrients from the peer-reviewed scientific literature in a diet that is shown to build up the immune system and protect us against diseases.
No, I think it's brilliant. I think it's brilliant. People should understand I'm an ardent defender of choice.
The average kid,
as well. Yeah.
The average kid vaccinated, and the average kid given a really healthy diet. Now you have something that at least would show what is occurring. But we're not doing that. And so the science that is now being argued, in my opinion, is not science. It's a cult. Your thoughts, please.
Right. So, Gary, what's broken is not that science itself, it doesn't work. So what you just described would be a fantastic research program. An entire department of nutritional immunology would be a great thing to see at all major universities, right? If they used, and if everyone used the tools of science, I have a whole initiative called Unbreaking Science. You can find it at hashtag Unbreaking Science, where I lay out what is wrong with the types of the way that science is being implemented. And yes, the wrong questions are being asked, but they're also being asked the wrong way, many times intentionally. It is very well known that most public research is unreliable. And yet there it sits in the journals, and people become tenured professors on the basis of the number of publications, not on the basis of the quality or the impact that they have on human pain and suffering or human health. And so, in a nutshell, Gary, what we have to do is move away from weak epidemiology, social sciences, psychiatry, and so on used to be called soft sciences because all they could do were association-type studies. Now vaccines, which are supposed to have saved the world and they're a public health tool that are used in hundreds of millions of people every year, they're only done with the weakest form of science, they're only evaluated with the weakest form of science. I can see a future where all science is based on our ability to not only just detect an effect or detect, a change in a person's health or improvement in a person's health, but to be able to predict the factors that will help individuals. And I'm talking about individualized medicine. I'm talking about a fairly sophisticated area of machine learning-based prediction modeling, where in those three groups that you just outlined, we could look at the baseline health indicators, the data. We could also look at the outcomes after 5 years and to see if we could have predicted which interventions were both super beneficial to certain individuals and were detrimental to some individuals. As you know, there's some foods that have some risks for some people, too. And vitamin E is fantastic, but it has a tolerance limit, and vitamin A is wonderful if you have measles. And yet there's some people where vitamin A is more toxic than others. And so if we could really just move away from, I'd like CDC, I'd like FDA, I'd like all universities involved in human health to stop using epidemiology to study medical problems, first of all. We need to really just stop that. It's the wrong tool. If you find a negative if you find a positive association of a extremely profitable medical intervention or treatment, you can always throw that positive association away as falling. The evidence falls short of causality, which is what the IOM did in a very near criminal manner over vaccines in the 2000s, in 2012 up to 2012. But if we could actually take the data about a patient and put it through structured algorithms that are taught how to predict which interventions are most effective for groups of people and individuals, then we could actually be intelligent, and we don't have to guess, and we don't have to make unwarranted generalizations, and we don't have to rely on misinformation campaigns and propaganda and coercion. This is a more gentle, kind of humane approach to it, and I think nutrition absolutely plays a huge part in that future. of the ketogenic diet, for instance, and its effect on cancer really needs to be studied as par for the course. It should be looked at as a potential mainstream consideration. And every oncologist, every time, should always tell every patient, stop the sugar. Stop sugar and stop simple starches. You have to go look at what the nutritionists are saying about how to stop hurting yourself by feeding your cancer the energy that it thrives on, and make the cancer earn its way in your body, and your body's better at it than the cancer is. And so, yeah, I'm all for that, Gary. I want to draw a line between science and science-like activities. And what I see are a lot of science-like activities. And it's easy for the layperson to confuse science-like activities that are not bona fide science, in my view, with tried and true principles and practices of real science. So, I admire the message. I'm on board with you for nutrition. Yeah, we can build that future.
I would like to complete our discussion with what is currently a very controversial topic. Virtually the entirety of the mainstream media is headlining the new story that vaccines proven not to cause autism. Well, first of all, it's not all vaccines. It was the MMR vaccine. You have studied the actual the study itself that was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine. We have come up with, and thanks to Ginger Taylor, 157 research papers that prove association between vaccine and autism. I just want to cite some of these because all the people listening will have access to this. And these, I'm only going to do a few samples to show that they're wrong. And so the mainstream media says it's found that vaccines and their ingredients are safe. Well, we have found that the ingredients can cause the underlying medical conditions that committed physicians and researchers who are commonly finding in children. I mentioned these some of the beginning of the program, including autoimmune conditions, which are epidemic, but also autism diagnosis. There are currently 3.5 million children diagnosed with autism, 7 million parents. These conditions also include gastrointestinal damage, immune system impairment, chronic infections, mitochondrial disorders, neurological regression, glial cell activation, interleukin-6 secretion dysregulation, brain inflammation, damage to the blood-brain barrier, seizures, synaptic dysfunction, dendritic cell dysfunction, mercury poisoning, aluminum that you've mentioned several times, toxicity, gene activation and alteration, glutathione depletion, impaired methylation, oxidative stress. These are just some of the conditions that are known to have an effect upon many bodies. Now, the fact that not all children will react the same, and not all will react at the same time. So they gave themselves an out. If you do not report a vaccine or suspected vaccine adverse effect within a very short period of time, for most it's 3 months, then you don't get compensated. Also, I interviewed a Dr. Kessler, former MD, PhD, director of the FDA, and he stated that the high percentage of adverse reactions are never reported, up to 90%. So if you take the number that are reported and add on an additional 90%, then you start realizing the figures are much greater. Also, when you look at the actual science, here are actual science from peer-reviewed literature where people did not have, that we could find, a financial interest. But the first one I'm going to share with you is probably one of the most important. It's from the Division of Epidemiology and Surveillance, Vaccine Safety and Development Branch of the National Immunization Program at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. This is the government's own study. It was in 1999. The lead author was a Thomas M. Vera Stratton, but also Robert Davis, David Gu, Frank Stefanoffo. And this was about the concern, had been raised of the presence of ethyl mercury containing preservative thimerosal in vaccines. And what they found was that when they did the study, they used the methods, they talk about methods and results. I'm going to quote directly from the results. Quote, within this group, we also found an elevated risk for the following disorders: autism, non-organic sleep disorders, and speech disorders. For the neurologic degenerative and renal disorder group, we found no significant increased risk or decreased risk. But listen to the number one thing they said. Their number one disorder was autism. Now, what happened to that? Well, then this is their conclusion. Quote, this analysis suggests that high exposure to ethyl mercury from thimerosal-containing vaccines in the first month of life increases the risk of subsequent development of neurologic development impairment. Well, okay. So they're saying that they have a problem with autism. So what happened was, did they publish this as is? No. They met at a secret conclave, and they decided not to release that information, but instead to cover it up, to thin it out. And all the people there, including the CDC, the FDA, the World Health Organization, but most importantly, the vaccine makers, representatives, were all present in figuring out how do we hide this information that vaccines with mercury increase autism spectrum disorder. That was a secret conference. Now, we would never have known this took place because they refused to allow any publicity, no news, no one could take notes, no one could record it, but someone did secretly. And Robert F. Kennedy Jr., through a Freedom of Information Act, got this information. And as a result, they have never been held accountable. They have never had to explain themselves. But it showed that the government's own study in 1999 showed that this was occurring. So I think that that is a crime against humanity. Then that was only the first. There were other ones as well. So in any case, I'd like for you to address the fact that the government's own scientists, not just once, not with that study, the Vera Stratton study, but separately, just a couple years after that, the CDC did its own study, and one of the lead authors and researchers was Dr. William Thompson. He also found that in young African-American boys, 36 months and younger, there was up to a 224% plus increase in autism spectrum disorder. Once again, just like the Vera Stratton, they didn't know what to do with it. So all the top people going clear to the top of the CDC decided covered up, destroy the evidence. So they talk about, and this is all recorded, we have this, where they brought in black garbage bags and put all this in the garbage bags and destroyed it. Except he felt, what if I'm ever asked to testify? What if I have to provide this and I don't want to get in trouble? So he kept a copy. That copy is in the hands of a Representative Posey from Florida, who's been trying for years to have Dr. Thompson brought in and testify under oath before a committee of Congress that the CDC knew there was an autism relationship, covered it up, and destroyed evidence, engaged in a criminal act, and then not a single hearing has been held because the vaccine manufacturers and their lobbyists have kept this hearing from happening. That's only two instances of them covering up the evidence. I want you to address that. But also I have here from the Journal of Translational Sciences. This is a major peer-reviewed journal, and this was done by a group of scientists at the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics, School of Public Health, Jackson State University. And it stated, let me go to the conclusions of this. It says, vaccinated children were significantly more likely than the unvaccinated to have been diagnosed with allergic rhinitis and eczema, dermatitis. So the people who were vaccinated were substantially more, suffered from chronic illness, 44% more than those who didn't. That's just one. Hepatitis B vaccine of male neonates and autism diagnosis. This is from the Journal of Toxicological and Environmental Health. And I'll just read one line, quote, from their study. Boys vaccinated as neonates had a 300% greater odds for autism diagnosis compared to boys never vaccinated, vaccinated after the first month of life. Now, we have 165 more studies associating vaccines, different types, with autism spectrum disorder. And yet you would never know that listening to CNN, reading the New York Times, or the major medical publications. Your thoughts, please.
Absolutely, Gary. So that's an accurate history. I can confirm all of that. Simpson Wood meeting, the restraint in the VSD study. They changed their methodology in the VSD data, spent 4 years to try to find ways to make the association go away. First Strayton wrote to CDC, as you recall, and said, "I can't, you know, it just won't go away," was the title. All of this is reviewed in my book, The Environmental and Genetic Causes of Autism, for which I read over 2,000 studies. I have no doubt in my mind that we know how vaccines cause autism better than we know the mechanisms of some of the drugs that are being approved today by the FDA, mechanisms of action. So when I'm talking about, you know, pulling forward, going forward, I don't think we should throw science out just because there's a cabal in illegal that hold illegal meetings like the Simpson Wood meeting, not inviting the public, that work systematically to hide the adverse events from their effect. It is a crime against humanity. And the reason why I have faith in science as an enterprise in the right hands is I did over 100 studies with people who would never have done that. I never saw the typical scientist at universities would never tolerate that type of egregious cover-up in their own science. Most of the reason why science that's conducted today is mostly irreproducible is because the perverse incentives that are there cause people to do to budget for small studies, which are unreliable, so they can get more publications rather than do one large study, which would consume all the resources. So we can't do anything but look to the law eventually for prosecution for people who have, you know, broken the law. And I hope someday, and I'm working on, you know, a number of cases with lawyers to bring people before a judge. My first reaction when I learned all of that was to sue the CDC, to sue the CDC to have them change their website to vaccines may cause autism in some people. That project was put on hold as a request from Robert F. Kennedy and his team because they were going forward with an initiative by which they got the HHS to admit that they hadn't reported to Congress every 2 years on the progress in satisfying the mandates. Well, that really hasn't led to change. We don't see anything in the area of change in the website or change admission of responsibility or so on. And so the CDC, the IPAC CDC Accountability Project is going to be brought back online later this year. There's a case right now that you may know of, fraud. Doe versus Merck, brought forward by Patricia Finn, an attorney in New York City, over a family being defrauded. For all of these reasons, in the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, because they were denied compensation for their child's autism from the MMR, and one of the stipulations of that lawsuit is that Merck would no longer be able to distribute the MMR vaccine in the state of New York. So there are solutions that I'm working towards and working with other people to bring about real change. And we have to defend the right to choose. We must not see universal mandates without choice. And one of the things that I say about that issue is 100% vaccination coverage means 100% vaccine injury. And I don't mean that every person that gets a vaccine is going to suffer the same degree of injury. What I mean is that there's a genetic subgroup, it's a heterogeneous subgroup, that cannot tolerate vaccines as well as others, that cannot tolerate specific vaccines or cannot tolerate vaccination with aluminum or with mercury, as well as others. And these individuals, you know, some people like Dr. Jim Meehan are calling for universal genetic testing to see if a person's at risk. That would be the biomarker approach. I would support that after we make vaccines as safe as possible first. I think it's unethical to put up a biomarker screen knowing that they're going to be bringing in more vaccines into the schedule without fixing the technology first. The liability that they have is widespread. It's shared. The culpability is widespread and shared. And we need a reform, a major reform with a capital R in science, not just about vaccines. We need people to feel strongly that they not only can speak out about vaccine risk, but they should speak out. And of course, Mark Zuckerberg and others are now censoring discussion about vaccine risk. It's on social media. That's the first step towards universal censoring like they have in Australia. But Gary, anybody who knows me knows that even under the threat of arrest and imprisonment and being fined, I won't stop talking about things that are harming children, whether it's vaccines or child abuse.
That's one of the reasons you were invited on today, because the courage to stand up to the power base. We thank you very much for contributing your insights today.
Thank you, Gary.
That's Dr. James Linz Weiler, Weiler. Thank you all for listening and have a good day.
Brother, brother, there's far too many of you dying.